Benedict somehow stayed fractions of an inch ahead, or to the side, or beneath the sweeping limbs, dancing back before the onrushing silk weaver, his feet hardly seeming to touch the floor. When the silk weaver's jaws snapped at his face, they met with nothing but a short, vicious strike of his sword. The beast shrieked in pain and charged Benedict furiously, following her cousin out into the center of the room, and Gwen realized that Benedict had led the creature there intentionally, to expose it to attack from all sides.
"Now!"
Gwen shouted as she reached the bar. "Attack!" Commodore Pine let out a bellow, hefted his chair, and charged the silk weaver, and the other surviving patrons of the Black Horse joined him. Some of the men had swords, and Gwen saw at least one gauntlet in evidence, but most were armed with chairs and knives. Their faces were pale, their voices cracking in screams that were more of terror than ferocity. But they knew as well as Gwen did that once a large predator of the surface began to spill human blood, it would not stop until it had killed every living person it could reach. Something about the taste of it maddened them, drove them to a savagery that was far beyond that of a mere hungry animal, though no one had ever provided an explanation as to why. Two of the younger men fell before they could even reach the silk weaver with their improvised weapons, clubbed down by lightning strikes of its many limbs. The rest closed on the silk weaver's flank, knives and swords stabbing, and the creature scuttled sideways, lashing out as it went, sending up more screams, until Commodore Pine closed from the opposite side of the silk weaver and brought his heavy chair down through a ponderous, swooping arc with all the strength of his stocky frame. The chair had a wooden seat, but the rest of it was made of coppered iron. It had to have weighed 40 pounds if it weighed an ounce, and Pine swung it with such force that the impact bent and twisted it. The silk weaver's armor might have protected its vitals from the shattering power of the blow, but nonetheless the force of the Olympian aeronaut's strike slammed the beast to the floor, sending its legs out in a wide sprawl and stunning it for a portion of a second. In the brief half-instant of weakness, Benedict attacked. With the same coughing roar Gwen had heard in the tunnels, Benedict closed on the silk weaver, his sword striking once, twice, three times, spinning in swift, heavy, vicious circles. Benedict wielded an exceptionally dense, weighty sword that had been intentionally created for use with his enhanced physique, and Gwen knew it would strike with terrible power. Three of the silk weaver's limbs went spinning away from its body, amidst gouts of violet fluid, and it staggered back, rough limbs slipping on the bloodied spirestone floor. Pine shouted, banging the twisted chair down onto the silk weaver with less effect the second time, and then was struck in the chest and sent flying back. The silk weaver's rear sections swept left and right like a curling tail, battering three more men and sending them reeling. But the old marine and several of his companions began driving their blades toward the creature's belly and its vulnerable flank. The silk weaver shrieked as more violet blood flowed and whirled on the men with unmistakable fury. They raised their weapons, but were simply no match for the thing, their knives and short swords unable to penetrate the creature's shell once it had faced them. It rushed them, tearing and smashing, breaking bones and rending flesh. Benedict roared again, but even his blade could not penetrate the silk weaver's armored shell and thudded futilely against it, slicing scrapes and fissures in the hide but drawing no blood. Even when he discharged his gauntlet nearly flush against the thing's hide, it did nothing to distract the silk weaver, and men screamed and fell before it, leaving Benedict standing alone. The silk weaver whirled on her cousin, flailing with its severed stumps of limbs, sending a spray of fluids at his face before it rushed forward. Benedict reeled back as the thing's blood filled one of his eyes, and began to dodge and weave again. But now the floor was slick with scarlet blood and violet, and the silk weaver was not charging with blind violence. Instead, it circled, forcing Benedict to retreat from it in a spiral, and it wasn't until a few seconds later that Gwen realized that as it had advanced, the silk weaver had laid a strand of sticky ether silk on the floor behind it.
"Benny, look out!"
Gwen screamed. Benedict's boot touched the silk strand on the floor and adhered to it almost instantly. Her cousin fell. The silk weaver rushed forward for the kill. Benedict's gauntlet went off with a howl, his blood-shrouded face twisted into a snarl. The silk weaver wrenched its body and the massive humps of armor around its relatively tiny head shielded it from harm. And then a lumen crystal tore itself from its sconce, flew across the room like a blazing star, and struck the silk weaver precisely between the eyes.
"Semper Fortitudo!"
Master Ferris slurred in a bellow.
"Over here, you great gawking thing! Leave that boy alone! I'm the one you're looking for!"
Had Gwen doubted the silk weaver's intelligence before, its reaction would have convinced her of its awareness and purpose. At the sound of Ferris's voice, the thing whirled with blinding speed and spent an endless second simply focused upon the old etherealist in what could only have been a shock of recognition. And then it let out the most blood-curdling shriek it had uttered yet. A second lumen crystal darted from a sconce and bounced off the silk weaver's head. The creature's weirdly segmented eyes seemed to flinch away from the cool blue light.
"Come on, then!" Ferris snarled. "What are you waiting for? An engraved invitation?"
The silk weaver screamed again and rushed at the old man. Gwen found herself in motion. She seized a glass bottle of the most potent liquor in the tavern in her right hand and flung it toward the empty space between the silk weaver and Master Ferris. Then, as the bottle tumbled, she raised her gauntlet. There was no time for careful sighting. Instead, she relied upon the hours and hours of practice she had put in to sense the precise moment to blast the tumbling bottle. She triggered her gauntlet, and white light leapt from the crystal on her palm across the room to the bottle. It exploded at once into a rapidly expanding shower of blue flame, a shower that fell directly onto the silk weaver's back and head. Fire suddenly wreathed the creature, burning skin and blackening armored hide, sending it staggering, thrashing and bucking in pain.
"Master Ferris!"
Gwen shouted, and sprinted toward the old man. It seemed to take an endless amount of time, but could only have been a few seconds. She reached the etherealist's side just as the silk weaver shuddered and its wild contortions ceased. Still aflame, it spun toward the etherealist again, and once more rushed forward, making a horrible, hissing sound as it came. Gwen pushed Master Ferris behind her and raised her gauntlet. The burning silk weaver was coming fast, its agonized body still contorting strangely, its small head thrashing. Gwen would have only a single chance to kill the creature, and she dared not waste it. She planted her feet firmly, straightened her back, squared her shoulders, and took a steadying breath. Then she sighted carefully between her fingers and waited. The silk weaver came on, hissing and charging, burning and smoking, its mouth and club-like limbs smeared with blood. When it was no more than 5 feet away, Gwen loosed the bolt from her gauntlet. Then there was an impact so vast that she could scarcely credit it as anything but a delusion, a sense of rapid, brutal motion, and a blossom of agony in her skull. And then nothing. Chapter 38. Spire Albion, Habble Landing, Ventilation Tunnels. Bridget stared for a moment at the remains of the silk weavers, then turned on her heel and walked decisively down the passageway, back toward their nest.
"My goodness!" Folly breathed.
Bridget had helped her collect her scattered crystals, most of them smeared with fine ash, some with more gruesome remains, and the girl had refilled the mesh bags in her holsters and was fixing the lid back onto her jar.
"What is Bridget doing?"
"Hundreds of little silk weavers didn't just pop out of the air," Bridget said back firmly.
"They hatch from eggs, do they not?"
"Something must have laid the eggs."
"She is, of course, correct,"
Folly whispered to her jar.
"But it seems to me that is an excellent reason for us not to go back in that direction.
Doesn't it seem that way to you?"
"If there was a mother present, would she not have attacked us as well?" Bridget asked.
"Raoul?"
The cat, prowling along at Bridget's side, paused to flick ashes off of one paw, his expression irritated.
"It stands to reason, little mouse."
"Then the mother is not present," Bridget said.
"We should look at the lair. It could be that we will learn something. Or be webbed up, or poisoned, or eaten,"
Folly said in a small voice.
"Eaten all up."
Bridget paused and looked back at the etherealist's apprentice.
"Folly," she said, "I understand that you're frightened. I am too. But we were sent out to get information, and what do we have to show for it?"
Folly didn't look up at Bridget, but frowned down at her gently glowing jar of crystals.
"If you don't want to go," Bridget said, "then we can walk back to an illuminated hallway, and I'll go myself, if you'll lend me your jar."
Folly clutched the jar of little crystals to her bosom and bit her lower lip.
"Oh, no, 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 I couldn't do that. That would be a violation of trust."
"We have a mission," Bridget said. "We'll need the light."
"We?"
Raoul asked smugly.
"Oh,"
Bridget said, scowling down at the cat for a moment. Then she looked up at Folly.
"Please, Folly, we'll do just a little more, and then we'll go back."
Folly took a deep breath. Then she nodded, very quickly, as if eager to get the motion over with. Climbing the ropes was difficult, and it was made no easier by the fact that Raoul insisted upon riding up on her shoulders.
"Why do you breathe that hard?"
the cat asked her curiously.
"Does it help in some way?"
Bridget made an incoherent snarling sound, secured her feet on the too narrow length of ether silk wedged between them, and strained to push her arms up another foot or so.
"Your shoulders are shaking,"
Raoul noted.
"It isn't very comfortable for me. Are you sure you're doing this correctly?"
Bridget ground her teeth and kept climbing.
"It's perfectly simple," Raoul said impatiently. "Watch."
And with that, the cat seized the length of ether silk with his forepaws, taking it firmly in his stubby grip. Then he hunched up his rear quarters, lifted his back paws, and sank his claws into the ether silk line. He slid his front paws up, and with effortless grace shinnied up the last 3 feet of line and disappeared into the opening in the masonry ceiling.
"You see?"
His voice came down.
"You should be more like that. It's faster, and one need not puff like a steam engine."
This time Bridget managed to growl,
"Kill that cat,"
putting as much threat as she could into the words. Then she hauled herself laboriously up the last few feet, heaved her upper body over the edge of the hole, and tried not to panic at how exquisitely vulnerable she felt, lying on her belly on what was presumably a silk weaver nest. There was a strange, acrid odor thick in the air, a scent that made her skin crawl, and she could see almost nothing in the darkness. Had a foe been present, Raoul would have warned her. That was, after all, why he had proceeded into the nest first, bless his fuzzy, arrogant heart. But even Raoul couldn't sense everything, every time. Bridget wasn't sure she wanted to come any farther up. If a silk weaver should leap at her, she wanted to be able to drop back down at once. Of course, if she did so, and lost her grip on the lines, she would fall 20 feet to the spirestone floor. Statistically, she had heard, surviving such a fall was a toss of the coin. Granted, the chances of surviving the poison of a silk weaver were worse.
"Bother,"
She didn't need mathematics. She needed to look and get it over with and get out of this horrible place. She primed her gauntlet, and the crystal on her palm glowed and crackled with power, sending a wash of tingles up her arm to the elbow. But it hadn't really been designed for illumination, and the light from it seemed to spread out and accomplish nothing practical. All it really did was to leave her blind to anything more than a few feet away. But at least, she supposed, its glow managed to make her into a much better target than she'd been a moment before.
"Folly,"
Bridget called, trying to keep her voice steady. "Send up the light." Bridget expected the etherealist's apprentice to tie the jar to the line of ether silk so that Bridget could haul it up. Instead, she heard Folly open the jar. Bridget grunted and pulled herself the rest of the way up, so that she could turn and peer back down through the hole at the other girl. Folly took the end of the ether silk line in her hand, closed her eyes for a moment, and then slipped it into the jar of gently glowing crystals. She said something, quietly, speaking in the same tone of voice one might use when addressing small children. And then there was a flickering of light amongst the crystals, and their quiet luminance abruptly spread into the ether silk line and up it, like water flowing through a pipe. Bridget watched in amazement as the light spread up the line, branching out into the other strands of ether silk it crossed, until it passed into the silk at the edge of the hole and beneath her, and then on into the silk-covered chamber beyond, until the entire thing pulsed with a muted aqua glow. Raoul let out a quiet sound, an expression of pure emotion Bridget had heard only a few times in her life, when a cat was impressed but did not wish to acknowledge the fact. The nest was covered in ether silk. The walls, the floor, the roof, like some vast cocoon, spreading from the hole in the floor up to the height of the spire-stone roof above, with walls composed of more silk. It was, Bridget thought, stunned, the fortune of a commoner's lifetime, the silk representing enough value to buy her father's vattery whole a dozen times over. She gave her head a small shake and forced herself to look past the treasure the silk represented. She scanned the nest again, straining to see details. There were tiny nodules of silk all over the floor and lower walls of the nest, each the size of an adolescent's fist. Some sort of cradles for the little silk weavers? Each bore a similar funnel pattern, where the silk weaver would obviously have eased into the cradle. High above the floor of the nest was a much, much larger cradle, one seemingly large enough to host three or four of Bridget. The silk weaver matriarch's bower? And between the enormous bower and the tiny cradles were more funnel shapes, much larger than those below, yet smaller than the one above. None of them, as far as Bridget could see, were occupied.
"This is why the nine claws were all huddled together," Bridget breathed.
"This is what Norn wanted us to see,"
Raoul said, his tone that of a teacher correcting a student.
"Also that,"
Bridget said quietly. Then she nodded.
"Let's go back. Master Ferris must know of this at once."
Chapter 39 Spire Albion, Havel Landing Shipyards, AMS Predator. Grimm spent the evening filling in for the ship's cook, who had been given leave along with a quarter of the ship's crew. Unfortunately, Journeyman hadn't bothered to inform the cook or his assistant that he'd brought an extra 20 men aboard to labour in the engine room. Journeyman was a simple soul, and the length and breadth of his universe could be described in precisely the same terms as the area of the ship's engineering spaces. The evening meal had therefore been woefully inadequate, and someone had to step in. Creedy had been nearly apoplectic when Grimm had calmly removed his captain's coat from his shoulders and donned an apron. In Fleet, such a thing would never have been conceived. A ship's captain was her master and the right hand of God in heaven himself, and concerned with matters of such grave importance that minor issues like food for the mortals in his command were entirely beneath him.
"I'll get someone else to take this duty, sir," Creedy said stoutly.
"The non-essential personnel are already on leave, Exo," Grimm replied. "All the remaining hands are fully engaged in installing the new systems and making repairs.
You know that."
"But, sir," Creedy said, "what will the crew say?"
"What they won't say, Byron, is anything like, 'My captain allowed me to go hungry while demanding that I work without cease,'" Grimm said. Creedy moved his arms in an abortive gesture of frustration.
"Sir, it just isn't natural for a ship's master."
"Nonsense. The Olympian Navy holds that a captain should know the details of every position in his ship's company by working them with his own hands, stem to stern. It's the only way to be sure you know what each man needs from his captain in order to be able to perform his duty."
Creedy's handsome face screwed up in protest. "We are not Olympians, sir."
"Surely as Albions we need not believe that we already possess all the sum of the world's wisdom. Are we not better bred than that, Mr. Creedy?"
"But, sir, you can't possibly expect me to take my meal from you as if you were any other cookie in the galley."
"Indeed not," Grimm said gravely, and held out a second apron. "As I still have only one reliable arm, I require your assistance. Coat off and look sharp, Mr. Creedy. There are tubers need peeling."
Kettle walked through the crowded mess hall and brought his bowl and spoon back up to the galley counter after the meal, grinning broadly at Creedy. The XO scowled at him. There were bits of something, perhaps shavings of tuber skins, in his hair, and he'd cut his hand twice. Grimm had cleaned and covered each wound carefully before sending the young officer back to work, and Creedy's temper was worn thin.
"Do you have a problem, Mr. Kettle?"
"No, sir," Kettle drawled. "Just wanted to give my compliments to the skipper on his captaining."
"His captaining?" Creedy asked. Grimm kept a grin from spreading over his mouth.
"Yes, sir, indeed. The hands and I all agree he's a damned fine captain."
Creedy regarded Kettle without humour.
"I see. Best captain in the sky, maybe."
"I understand," Creedy said.
"There's rarely been a finer captain, we reckon," Kettle said expansively.
"You have made your position clear, Mr. Kettle," Creedy all but snapped. "I'm sure the captain appreciates it."
Kettle nodded and put the bowl down. Creedy snatched it up, scowling.
"So, Skip," he asked with perfect innocence, "when will Waller get back into the galley so you can get back to captaining?"
"Why, Mr. Kettle," Grimm said, "one is tempted to think that you do not approve of your captain's cooking."
"No, sir," Kettle said. "You'll never hear me complain, sir. I'm just a much bigger admirer of his captaining, sir."
"Mind your heading, Kettle," Creedy snapped.
"Why, I should..."
Grimm put a gently restraining hand on Creedy's shoulder.
"Cook should be back on board by midnight, I dare say."
"I'll spread that around," Kettle said,
nodding to them pleasantly, and went back to his place at a table. Creedy frowned after him for a moment, and then turned to Grimm, lowering his voice.
"Sir, the men shouldn't be able to criticize the captain openly like that."
"I didn't hear a word of criticism, XO," Grimm replied.
He grunted with effort and dumped the last of the simple stew he'd made of the insufficient meal Waller had left behind into a large bowl, which held a double-sized portion of the food.
"Kettle was merely expressing himself. That man knows how to complain flawlessly."
He looked at Creedy.
"You had a few mouthfuls when you could, Byron. I saw you. What did you think of my stew?"
Creedy looked suddenly discomforted.
"It was perfectly nourishing, sir. With salt, practically palatable."
Grimm smiled and began cleaning up. Creedy blinked several times.
Sir, do you mean to say you made that on purpose?
Command is about more than knowing the protocol, Byron, Grimm said. Whose fault was it that not enough dinner had been prepared?
Mine, sir,
Creedy said stoutly. I should have kept an eye on Journeyman, sir. His section was extraordinarily busy. There are small grounds to reprimand him.
By the book, perhaps, but you and I were both supervising different sections of the ship, and he's the chief of the engine room.
He should damned well be thinking about his men and the hired hands, as well as his systems.
That's a very fine distinction, sir.
Grimm shook his head. The men know exactly what happened, and there are reprimands that have nothing to do with the book. He carried the double portion bowl over to the counter.
Mr. Kettle,
he called.
The pilot looked up. Aye, Skip.
The chief hasn't come out of his precious engine room to eat. Perhaps you and some of the men can see to it that he sits down long enough to feed himself.
Kettle eyed the double portion bowl askance, and then slowly beamed.
Aye, Captain. He's working so hard, he deserves nothing less.
Creedy watched Kettle pick up the bowl and head out. Virtually every man in the mess hall went with him.
What are they going to do?
Creedy asked with a certain amount of fascination.
Watch Chief Journeyman eat every bite without salt, I should think, upon peril of their extreme displeasure.
Grimm said,
and go very hard on him the entire time for foregoing such a basic responsibility and costing them a decent meal.
The young officer frowned.
Sir, it seems a bit hard on the men to proceed this way.
Nonsense, Exo,
Grimm said.
The food was technically nourishing, and they all ate the fill.
We've done our penance in their eyes for not making sure the problem was avoided in the first place. He winked at Byron and started shrugging back into his coat.
And after all, we can hardly have them wanting their captain to cook dinner when someone screws up by the numbers now, can we? After all, I have a ship to run.
Creedy considered that for a long moment before he said, "You have a devious mind, sir." Grimm looked up at the tall young officer and dropped his voice into a more serious register.
Strategy and tactics, discipline and protocol are necessary, but they're just the beginning. You have to know people, Byron. How they think, what motivates them. Watch. Learn.
Creedy stared at Grimm for a long moment, then he nodded and said,
I will.
Good man.
You've hardly slept, sir, Creedy said. I'll take the next watch. Go get some rest.
Good of you, Grimm said, and took up his coat again. I'll be in my cabin if I'm needed.
Grimm nodded to Byron, tried to ignore the pervasive ache that had spread from his injured arm out into every other fibre of his being, shambled to his cabin, hung up his coat, and flung himself down on his bunk without bothering to undress. He was asleep before the faint scent of Calliope's perfume that still lingered on the covers could bring back memories, unhappy or otherwise. A sharp rap at his door brought Grimm abruptly out of his first sound sleep in days, almost before it had begun. He managed to sit up and swipe the rather less than captainly drool from his chin before the door opened and Creedy poked his head in with an apologetic expression.
Sir?
Grimm suppressed a groan. Captains were not subject to such mortal infirmities as sleep deprivation.
Yes, Exo.
Several of the men came back early from their leave, sir. They say there's been some kind of situation involving your passengers, sir.
Trouble.
People were killed and injured.
Grimm swung out of his bed at once and rose, ignoring the protests of his weary body. At least he was still dressed.
Kettle and an armed party of four to be ready to leave with me, including the men bearing the report. Dr. Bacon and his bag will accompany us. We leave immediately, to be briefed en route to Master Ferris's party.
Aye, sir,
Creedy said with a brisk nod, and withdrew from Grimm's cabin, bellowing orders. Grimm took his wounded arm out of its sling long enough to properly don his coat, then added the sword belt and the sling again. The damned thing was a nuisance. The moment his arm was serviceable, he tossed the blasted sling over the side of the spire. It seemed likely that would happen faster if he could only get several hours of sleep all in a row. He checked to be sure that his sword would draw smoothly, slid it firmly back into its scabbard, settled his hat onto his head, and strode out to meet the moment. A deckhand named Harrison guided them to the Black Horse, an inn and pub. Even at the late hour, well after midnight, a small crowd had gathered around the place.
"I don't know what happened exactly, sir," Harrison was saying, "but there was screaming like souls in hell from inside, and what looked like smoke from a fire."
Another crewman, named Bennett, saw them coming and hurried over, flicking Grimm a quick salute.
"Sir, been watching it since Harry and the others left, sir."
"And?"
"No one has gone in or come out. The doors won't open, sir, but your passengers are inside. I was having a drink in there earlier, and that elderly fellow was leading around a Farmer Long's cucumber."
He nodded toward a couple of uniformed guardsmen over by the doors. They were young men, their uniforms not quite tidy, perhaps the least valued of their garrison, to be drawing the late shift. They seemed somewhat at a loss for what to do.
"These lads seem to be out of their depth, sir."
Grimm sighed and said, "Boarding axe, Mr. Kettle." Kettle turned to one of the other men of the party and caught a heavy-headed boarding axe as it was tossed to him. The thing was part axe and part sledgehammer, meant for battering down the doors or bulkheads of an enemy ship, not for true combat. It would make short work of the doors of the inn, Grimm judged.
"With me,"
Grimm said, and strode toward the young guardsman, Kettle at his back. They turned to him with a mix of uncertainty and anger on their faces.
"Here now," said one of them. "What's this, then?"
Grimm eyed the young man steadily. In moments of confusion, young soldiers were often comforted by authority figures who seemed to know what to do. The guardsman's back stiffened a little, and he nodded.
"Captain,"
he said, with at least a pretense of respect.
Grimm nodded back. "Guardsman," he said, "I have friends inside that building. I see that the doors have not been opened."
"They're stuck fast," said the second guardsman. "There are people inside shouting, but it's a demon's torment to hear them."
"I have an axe here," Grimm said. "Perhaps you would care to use it."
The guardsmen looked at each other. While the Spire Arch Guard might have been popular with the scions of the great houses of Albion, for a symbolic year or two at least, the majority of its long-term members were common men and women with widely varying backgrounds, and most of them had less extreme levels of endemic confidence.
"Bloody wooden doors are expensive," muttered the second guardsman. "It'll be a month's pay to replace one."
"Bill it to Captain Grimm of the airship Predator,"
Grimm said.
"Kettle."
"Aye, sir,"
Kettle said. He fired off a crisp salute and strode confidently toward the door.
"Can he do that?"
the first guardsman asked the second. The second said.
"Guardsman," Grimm said calmly, "perhaps you should supervise the opening of the door, to make sure no one is harmed, and to be on hand to assess the situation and render assistance as needed. Misters Bennett and Harrison, come here, please."
The two men did, firing off salutes of their own.
"You and the rest of the men will accompany these two guardsmen, and assist them in any way you can."
He turned back to the two guardsmen.
"You'll find my men cooperative, sirs. Master Bagan is my ship's physician, and he will be able to render aid to anyone who is wounded."
"Right," said the first guardsman, nodding. "Thank you for your assistance, Captain."
"But,"
the second guardsman said.
"Shut up, Malky. There's people in there need helping," said the first one.
He turned to the men from Predator, his stance and bearing more authoritative and confident.
"You lot come with us. Malky, clear those people back from the doors, eh? Last thing we need is someone to take that axe on the backswing."
Grimm watched things develop with a certain amount of satisfaction. Once given a direction, the young guardsman seemed willing and capable enough. It would probably eventually occur to them that they'd essentially been given orders by a civilian with no legal authority whatsoever, but they seemed to be more in their element now. He wondered whether either of them was secretly working with the Aurorans. It hardly seemed likely. But then, good spies never seemed likely, did they? He took a couple of steps back as the second guardsman herded the small crowd away from the doors of the inn and bumped into a woman who had been watching, sending her to the ground in a sprawl.
"Oof!"
the woman said, her expression a war between astonishment and anger. She wore an excellent suit of clothing in steely shades of lavender accented with grey, skirts and a bolero jacket with a matching hat. She was an attractive, sharp-edged woman, perhaps a few years older than Grimm, with large grey eyes devoid of any other colour and dark hair.
"How rude!"
"Madame, you are entirely correct," Grimm said. "I was careless, and do beg your pardon." He straightened and offered her a bow and then his good hand. "Moreover, I ask your forgiveness. In my eagerness to comply with instructions of the good guardsman, I fear that I did not adequately survey the space behind me before I moved. I am entirely in the wrong." The woman stared at him for several seconds, and Grimm had two sudden impressions. First, that she was searching his words for something that might displease her. Second, that this woman, whoever she was dangerous. The hairs on the back of his neck simply crawled. The woman narrowed her eyes abruptly, and for a wild instant Grimm wondered whether he might have been weary enough to have accidentally spoken his thoughts aloud. And then the moment was gone, and the woman offered him a tight, restrained smile.
"Of course, Captain. You are an airship captain, are you not?"
"Indeed, madame. Captain Francis Madison Grimm of Predator, at your service." Her wide, expressive mouth twitched at one corner.
"Oh, indeed? My name is Sycorax Cavendish."
She took his hand and rose.
"Thank you."
"You're quite welcome, Madame Cavendish," Grimm said. She smiled, though the expression was an empty bowl, somehow barren of what a smile was meant to contain.
"Are you the same Francis Madison Grimm as he who took command of the Perilous all those years ago?"
Grimm stiffened. Was that damned ship and the choices he made upon it to haunt him for the rest of his days? Yes, it was, he supposed. That was part of the price he had paid to do his duty. "The same," he said.
"Oh, Captain."
Madame Cavendish breathed.
"I have often wished to meet you."
"Then you are an exceptional individual. Such infamy as mine does not generally draw admirers, madame."
"I am,"
she replied.
"And as such, I'm well aware that there are often two sides to any given story, even when one side is Fleet Admiralty."
He gave her the wooden smile he presented to so many others over the years. "I pray you will forgive the bluntness of a simple aeronaut, madame, but I have nothing further to say about the matter."
"I can hardly fail to forgive when such a request is so politely offered,"
Madame Cavendish replied. There was something very hard and covered in jagged spikes behind her eyes as she said the words, as if the courtesy itself had somehow displeased her. Grimm found himself fighting a sudden desire to edge away from the woman. There was a movement in the crowd behind her, and then several people sidled away from a large man who had approached them. He was a tall, lean warrior-born, his pale head covered in sparse, grizzled fuzz. He was no beauty, and one of his eyes was fixed slightly to one side, making his gaze vague and a bit unsettling. When he saw Grimm, he let out a low growling sound in his chest and stepped forward, his body language aggressive. Grim had no desire to come to blows with a warrior born. That fight could not be won in a gentlemanly manner, and his instincts were warning him that any such action would be a mistake in the presence of Madame Cavendish. A flutter of white flickered downward in the corner of his eye as he faced the man.
"Good evening, sir."
The large warrior born scowled. He looked aside, giving Madame Cavendish a quick glance, or so it seemed to Grimm. The disparity of the man's gaze made it difficult to know for certain. Grimm was unaccountably reminded, looking at the man, of an enormous spider, something patient and lethal, waiting for its prey to come within reach. The moment the man looked away, Grimm turned on his heel, bent, and retrieved the handkerchief from where Madame Cavendish had let it fall to the ground near her feet.
"Pardon, madame," he said, "but you seem to have dropped this."
"And so I did,"
Madame Cavendish replied. Her dark eyes glittered brightly, almost feverish in their intensity.
"You have excellent manners, sir."
"My old protocol teachers at the Fleet Academy would be startled to hear you say so, I am sure," he said, adding a little bow to the words. Just then, Kettle's boarding axe crashed through the door of the Black Horse, and men began entering.
"If you would excuse me, Madame Cavendish, I must attend on what happens next." She offered her gloved hand, and, he felt, only barely managed to avoid speaking through clenched teeth.
"Of course, Captain. How could I do otherwise?"
Grimm bent over her hand and brushed a polite kiss over the glove, though he thought his skin might ripple entirely up the length of his spine and pile up atop his head as he did so.
"It was my pleasure to meet you, Madame Cavendish."
Acting again on instinct, he added,
"If you so desire, I am sure I can convince a guardsman to see you safely from this place."
Madame Cavendish's eyes flickered to the guardsman and back to Grimm, too wary to be the gaze of a simple woman of the upper classes. Her expression froze as she found Grimm watching her, and then the barest hint of a smile touched her lips. She inclined her head to Grimm like a fencer acknowledging a touch, and then said,
"That will not be necessary. I'm sure Mr. Sark can see me safely home."
The large warrior-born made another growling sound in his throat.
"Then, Madame Cavendish, Mr. Sark, I bid you good evening."
He bowed again, then turned and walked away. He did not allow himself to hurry. He didn't know what the two were up to, but he knew predators when he met them eye to eye, and it was never a good idea to show fear to such creatures. He walked past Malky with a firm step and a steady nod. The young guardsman didn't seem to question his presence, and Grimm joined Kettle at the door of the inn a moment later. The reek from inside was horrible. The first floor of the building looked and smelled like an abattoir.
"Merciful builders," Grimm breathed. "What happened here?"
"Looks like a silk weaver attacked them," Kettle reported. "A big one, sir. Webbed the doors shut and killed a lot of people."
"A silk weaver? Here?" Grimm demanded.
He squinted around the street. Though there were fewer lights here than one might expect in Habble Morning, it was still bright enough to clearly see objects 50 feet away.
"We're near the center of the Habble. How did it get here without being seen?"
"How'd it know to web all the doors shut and trap everyone inside?" Kettle asked. "Those things ain't that smart, sir."
Grimm grunted. He turned to check on the presence of Madame Cavendish and her companion, but they were no longer in sight.
"And it just happens to attack this inn. Has a bad smell to it, wouldn't you say, Mr. Kettle?"
"Even worse than your cooking, sir,"
Kettle confirmed. Grimm glanced at the man.
"That bad, was it?"
Kettle scratched at his short beard.
"Nah, suppose not,"
he replied.
"Mind you, 100 meals like that'd be a mutiny. One is just a good story."
Grimm grinned briefly.
"Dr. Bagan?"
"Inside with the others," Kettle said.
Harrison appeared a moment later and saluted Grimm.
"Captain,
Dr. Bagan's compliments, sir, and he says the Lancaster girl is wounded. He needs her in his infirmary at once.
The others of the party?
Alive and well, sir, but two are missing who were sent out a few hours ago.
Grim nodded. Have Bagan make the girl ready to move, then. Let's get them all back to Predator quickly. We'll leave Mr. Bennett and yourself here to round up the missing members of their group.
Sir,
Harrison said, and hurried back inside. Grim watched the man go and then looked around, scanning the crowd. He still found no trace of either Cavendish or Sark.
You've got your thinking face on, Captain,
Kettle noted. Grim said.
I was thinking that the Spyrarch sent his team to the right place.
Sir?
Kettle asked.
The enemy is here, Mr. Kettle, he said, and they're clearly on to us.
Let's get Master Ferris and his people out of here before the next attack.
Chapter 40 Spire Albion, Havel Landing Shipyards, AMS Predator. Grim and the shore party headed back to Predator, though he had an acutely uncomfortable sensation of being watched. He walked beside a quite inebriated Master Ferris, framing the old man between himself and Sir Benedict. The old etherealist could barely stagger along in a straight line, and was humming bits and pieces from a bawdy song beneath his breath as they travelled.
Captain,
said Sir Benedict. He was walking on Ferris's other side, keeping the old man moving along with the crew of Predator. He dragged Master Ferris's two overloaded wagons along behind him. The other two young ladies of our group were sent to...
I've left two men behind at the Black Horse to await them and bring them along when they return,
Grim said, interrupting the young man.
But what if they do not return?
Sorrelin asked, his voice tight.
They were to...
In that eventuality, I will dispatch a search party,
Grim said shortly, pointedly cutting him off again.
Let us not discuss anything further here, where we may be overheard, shall we, sir?
The young man scowled, but then seemed to think better of it and schooled his expression.
Of course, Captain. You are correct.
Grim gave him a short nod and felt a bit of his tension ease. Young Sorrelin was both warrior-born and of high birth. Grim had met all sorts from the upper classes in his time, most of them unremarkable in most respects. The ones who had prided themselves too much upon their position, by contrast, could be the most obnoxious human beings on the face of the earth, with Hamilton Rook representing the worst portion of that particular bell curve. Grim would not care to deal with Hamilton as a warrior born, but this young man seemed a more or less decent sort. They passed the rest of the walk back to the ship in silence, and Dr. Bagan and the men detailed to carry Miss Lancaster proceeded directly to his infirmary. Master Ferris tottered up the boarding ramp to the ship and promptly wobbled about to face Benedict.
My cane, if you please, Master Sorrelin.
Sorrelin shrugged the strap of a carrying case off his shoulder. A walking cane with a leather-wrapped head was strapped to the case, and Benedict removed it and passed it to the old etherealist.
"I'll just have a word with your ship, shall I?"
Master Ferris slurred. Grim arched an eyebrow at him and said,
"As you wish, sir."
The old man beamed and then turned and walked carefully down the deck, his wobbling steps steadied somewhat by the cane in his hand.
"All right," Grim said, turning to Sorrelin. "What happened in there?"
Grim listened as the young man told him of the Silkweaver attack in terse sentences. He finished with, "And then Gwen took up a firing stance right in front of the thing as it charged Master Ferris, and blasted half of its little head into pulp. It had enough momentum to slam into her and carry her into the wall, and it bit her at least once. But she killed it."
"Remarkable," Grim murmured. "That took more than a little courage."
Sorrelin smiled briefly.
"My dear cousin has a very odd relationship with fear, though mostly she's too busy to be bothered with it."
"I'm glad the rest of you are well. The enemy has made his first mistake."
"Sir?"
Sorrelin asked.
"It would have been smarter for them to do nothing," Grim said.
to give us no clue at all as to their presence. Instead, they've attacked Master Ferris.
With a silk weaver, sir?
Sorrelin asked, his tone sceptical. They've never been domesticated. Grimm glanced up at him.
Did it seem particularly tame to you?
Sorrelin frowned.
They've told us that Ferris is a threat to them, Grimm said. Therefore, we must be looking in the right place.
If it isn't just a random attack of a surface creature, sir, Sorrelin said, it might be a coincidence.
I don't believe in the stuff myself,
Grimm said, and idly flexed his wounded arm in its sling.
Although you're right, we shouldn't rule out the possibility. But how many large creatures do you think have harmed folk in the center of Habble Landing?
We could ask the Verminosters Guild, I suppose.
An excellent thought, said Master Ferris, as he came back along the deck toward them. If there's anything odd afoot, or an enemy force in the Habble, they'll be in the ventilation tunnels and crawl spaces. The Verminositors will be the next most likely group to have spotted something.
After who, sir?
Grimm asked.
The cats, of course, Ferris said. Your ship is quite insouciant.
Grimm found himself frowning.
Is she?
Terribly,
Master Ferris said gravely.
But I believe she understands the importance of cooperation.
Ah,
Grimm said.
Well, I must see what I can do to ensure that brave young Lancaster's sacrifice was not a vain one,
Master Ferris said.
Master Sorrelin, perhaps you and I could make inquisitions of the Verminositors.
But, sir, Sorrelin said, Bridget and Folly are still out there.
Well, Folly is quite capable of taking steps to protect them both if need be,
Master Ferris said,
and time is of the essence. But I suppose if you prefer to search for them...
I'm not supposed to leave your side, sir, Sorrelin noted. Master Ferris flipped his hand in an impatient gesture.
Did the Spyrarch place me in command of this mission, or did he not?
You may have heard about my issues with authority, Grimm said. Master Ferris, I believe it may have become too risky for you to roam about Habble Landing without taking extraordinary precautions. And certainly I believe Master Sorrelin is correct in not wishing to leave your side.
Ah?
Ferris asked.
And why is that?
I met someone outside the Black Horse while we were getting the doors open, Grimm replied. A woman who struck me as extremely odd and somewhat dangerous. She did not look like the normal sort out and about at that time of the night. Nor did she behave in a manner consistent with a genuine passer-by. She was accompanied by a warrior-born man. They seemed to be entirely too interested in seeing the results of the situation inside the Black Horse, with entirely too little interest in speculating upon what had happened. I suspect that they may be Auroran agents, or employed by them. Ferris narrowed his eyes.
Odd, you say? Why so?
If she is indeed connected to the Aurorans, an agent here in Albion, she would have to have ice water in her veins and be somewhat addled to be standing in plain sight at the scene of an attack, Grimm replied. He added rather delicately, The woman seemed at least as odd as yourself, sir, meaning no offence by it.
Oh, none taken,
Ferris said. He considered the crystal at the end of his cane gravely.
Inevitable that at least one Auroran operative would have talent. I had hoped it would be otherwise, but...
He shook his head.
You are a man of uncommonly acute instinct, Captain Grimm. What else can you tell me about this person?
Grimm pursed his lips.
She seemed unnaturally concerned with manners, sir. I gathered the impression, in fact, that if I had slipped up, she might have become violent, or asked her companion to do so on her behalf.
Of that I have little doubt, the etherealist replied, his expression distant.
She said her name was Cavendish.
Ferris grimaced.
So, she's calling herself Cavendish now?
Sir? Grimm asked. Do you know the woman?
"Most thoroughly, I suspect," Ferris replied.
"Then you must surely see the wisdom in keeping you here in order to protect you," Grimm said. "If she was involved in an attempt on your life once, why not do so again? More directly this time.
Should a warrior-born assassin surprise you inside the Havel, even Master Sorrelin could be hard-pressed to defend you."
"I see your point, Captain," Ferris replied.
"That said," Grimm continued, "I find it interesting that only hours before an Auroran attack upon Spire Albion, I should be assaulted in the ventilation tunnels by creatures unknown, creatures that left poison in my blood, much as silk weavers would. You helped me then. Assuming you are capable, perhaps you could help Miss Lancaster the way you assisted me." Ferris frowned, and his eyes began darting here and there.
"Yes. Yes, we really ought to do whatever we can for Miss Lancaster. So be it. You and Sorrelin will go."
Sir? Sorrelin said.
"Still not supposed to leave your side." "Ah, but I will be here, and quite safe, surrounded by the Grim Captain's ship and crew," Ferris said, smiling.
He tilted his head to one side and eyed Grim.
"Correct me if I'm wrong, but I seem to remember saving your life, Captain. Did I not?"
Grim sighed. "You did, sir."
"And does that not oblige you to me in some way?"
"It does."
"You must trust me in this. I know precisely what I'm doing."
The old man turned and began to walk with a determined stride toward Dr. Bagan's infirmary. Then he paused, looked back at Sorrelin, and said,
"I say, dear boy, could you get the doorknob for me? I never could learn the trick of the blasted things."
Sorrelin gave the etherealist a perfectly bland look. Then he smiled amiably, if wearily, and strode off after him, returning a moment later.
"Shall we speak to the Verminositas?" Grimm asked him.
"What now? In the middle of the night?"
"A silkweaver matriarch has killed some of their neighbors tonight,"
Grimm replied.
"Word will have spread by now. I doubt any of them will sleep for some time."
Sorrelin grunted and nodded, and the pair of them started down the gangplank. Halfway down, Grimm looked up to see Stern returning to Predator. The wiry young man was dressed in disgraceful-looking tattered rags and covered in grease, oil, and soot. When he saw Grimm coming down the ramp, he stepped aside to let his captain pass.
"Mr. Stern," Grimm said, "what is that covering you from head to toe? For a moment I took you for my shadow."
"Soot and engine grease, Skip,"
Stern said, grinning. "I take it you amused yourself thoroughly this evening."
"Indeed I did, sir. All went well."
"I'm relieved to hear it, but I can't have one of my aeronauts wandering about looking like a tunnel rat. Clean yourself up."
Stern grinned, and his teeth were a very white contrast to the soot.
"I'll do that, sir, right away."
"Good man,"
Grimm said, and began striding toward the archway leading into Havel Landing. Sorrelin looked back over his shoulder as the small sailor scampered up the gangplank.
"What was that about, Captain?"
"Accounts payable,"
Grimm replied.
"Do you know where the Guild has its headquarters?"
"If they haven't moved them,"
Sorrelin said.
"Then lead on, sir."
The warrior-born took the lead, and as he did, Grimm took note of the young man's appearance.
"You seem to be somewhat the worse for wear, sir. Did you take part in the fighting?"
"Some,"
Sorrelin said, "though it was Gwen who made the difference." Grimm nodded.
"What is her condition?"
"The bite wound was not severe, but it was poisoned. She has what might be a broken wrist," Sorrelin replied, his tone wooden but steady. "She also took a severe blow to the back of her head, and has been insensible ever since. Her head is swollen. The physician wasn't sure if her skull had been cracked or not." He showed his teeth in an unpleasant smile. "To think of all the times I ribbed her about having a hard head and a stiff neck. Now she's barely breathing."
"Hold fast, Master Sorrelin," Grimm said. "I've seen men who recovered from severe concussions in a day or two. Mr. Bagan knows his trade, and Master Ferris knows some things most of us don't, I dare say.
There is ample reason to hope. The warrior-born frowned.
I'm not sure how comforting that is, sir.
Master Ferris is... I do not wish to sound disrespectful.